So please join me in giving a very warm welcome to our speaker this evening, Father Dan Horan.
Thank you very much, Paul, and thank you to all of you for joining us this evening. Can you hear me okay? Good. I'm deeply privileged and honored to have been invited to be here with you this evening to talk about this incredibly important topic. The previous 12 lecturers have been people that many of whom are people that I consider mentors, friends, and colleagues, and so to have the opportunity to stand up here in the same place that they've stood to address important topics related to Thomas Merton, related to the history and culture and identity of those of African descent. And what I'd like to address more specifically with you this evening, the role of whiteness and white racial identity and its relationship to racial justice and Thomas Merton's understanding of racism in the U.S. context. It really is a deep honor to be here. So I thank Paul and Mark and those of the Thomas Merton Center, as well as all the other campus organizations that have co-sponsored this event. In what has been a classic reflection on the pervasiveness of systemic racism, deeply embedded as it is in so many unwitting presumptions, outlooks, statements, and questions of white women and men, the scholar and civil rights activist W.E.B. Du Bois opened his 1903 collection of essays titled The Souls of Black Folk with the following lines. He said, "Between me and the other world, there is ever an unasked question, unasked by some through feeling of delicacy, by others through the difficulty of rightly framing it. All nevertheless flutter around. They approach me in a half-hesitant sort of way, eye me curiously or compassionately, and then instead of saying directly, 'How does it feel to be a problem?' they say, 'I know an excellent colored man in my town,' or 'I fought at Mechanicsville,' or 'Don't these southern outrages make your blood boil?' At these I smile, or I'm interested, or reduce the boiling to a simmer, as the occasion may require. To the real question, 'How does it feel to be a problem?' I answer seldom a word." The power of Du Bois' unmasking of the tacit anti-black racism and the seemingly innocent questions of well-meaning white folk leads to his consideration of what he calls a double consciousness, that the structural, institutional, and historical realities of American racism forces upon people of color in general, and those women and men of African descent in particular. He adds in the same essay, he says, "It is a peculiar situation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder." Du Bois' reflection on the effects of the white gaze on his black body anticipates the reflections of Frantz Fanon half a century later, who likewise calls out the subjugating presence of whiteness and the deleterious effects on identity that come from our often unwitting performance of whiteness. Fanon says, "The white man is all around me. Up above the sky is tearing at its navel. The earth crunches under my feet and sings, 'White, white.' All this whiteness burns me to a cinder," declares Fanon. The generally unspoken, though sometimes, as we see even in our own times, terribly shouted presumption in a white supremacist context, such as that of the United States, is that racism is, to use Du Bois' language, a, quote, black problem, wherein those who are systematically disenfranchised, oppressed, silenced, and erased are made to believe that they are responsible, which is one of the many disturbing results of the performance of whiteness seen as identical to normativity and authentic selfhood. More on that in a minute. And as the theologian Kelly Brown Douglas and others rightfully note, in the United States and elsewhere, Christianity too has been complicit in the normalizing and promotion of anti-black racism in this way. An honest analysis of our national and ecclesial, that is our church contexts, reveals an often avoided truth that persons of color have known from the time of European colonization of indigenous American lands and the establishment of a slaveocracy on this continent. And it's simply this: racism is a white problem. This simple truth about a complex and historically entrenched reality appears in the writings of Thomas Merton. In his essay, Letters to a White Liberal, occasioned by Martin Luther King Jr.'s impassioned letter from Birmingham jail, Merton at one point reflects on the significance of the nonviolent protests for racial justice led by Dr. King and others. Merton writes, "The purpose of nonviolent protest in its deepest and most spiritual dimensions is then to awaken the conscience of the white man to the awful reality of his injustice and of his sin, so that he will be able to see that the Negro problem is really a white problem, that the cancer of injustice and hate which is eating white society is only partly manifested in racial segregation with all its consequences. It's rooted in the heart of the white man himself." As numerous Merton scholars, historians, and theologians, many of whom have stood on this stage in the decade plus before us this evening, as they have noted in decades since the publication of that essay in 1964, Merton was in many ways ahead of his time. His direct criticism of well-intentioned Northern whites, the so-called liberals of the Letters to White Liberals, for their lack of adequate self-reflection, humility, and openness to the righteous laments of the black population they so eagerly wished to assist, garnered both scathing blowback in his time and subsequently a lot of praise in ours. In sum, Merton is correct. Racism is a white problem, and he deserves appropriate credit for recognizing and naming what so many other white folk could not or would not do in his time, or frankly, in ours. But what has received far less attention is the role of Merton's own whiteness in his outlook and writings on racism and racial justice. In other words, is it simply enough to name the reality of racism as a white problem? What responsibility do those who identify or are perceived as white have in unpacking the claim that racism is a white problem? And are there limits to Merton's own self-awareness, his shifting perspectives on race in America, and both his diagnostic and prescriptive exhortations? Now, admittedly, those are some big questions, and a thorough study of these would far exceed the time we have here together, unless we want to make this an all-night vigil, in which case you can ask my students in Chicago. I have no problem going over the allotted course time. But I imagine many of you would like to go home tonight. So what I'd like to do is at least begin to consider some of these topics with you this evening. So in this lecture, I'd like to proceed in four parts. First, in order to understand the role of whiteness in the anti-racist writings and outlook of Merton, we need to briefly examine what it means in terms of race, social location, and interpersonal orientation. And here I'm going to draw on the work of philosophers and theorists, including Sarah Ahmed, George Yancey, Robin DiAngelo, and some others. Second, I argue that there is indeed a prophetic valence, a prophetic quality to Merton's anti-racist writings, which made notable contributions in his time and, frankly, beyond. I mean, particularly when we consider Catholic Christianity in the mid-20th century and, dare I say, in the now second, almost third decade of the 21st century. Third, in addition to those constructive contributions of Merton's thought, I believe there are limitations that we have to take seriously. Limitations to his own white self-criticality that have gone largely unexamined. And that's not by, you know, for any nefarious purpose within the Merton community or Merton scholars. As best I can tell, because his writings were so prophetic, people haven't necessarily taken that step forward to say, well, where are the limits of his prophetic call? Finally, I want to conclude this lecture with a brief presentation on Merton's insights for us today, particularly in light of the recent U.S. Bishop's pastoral statement on racism, which was released in November. I do want to acknowledge, and this is not a nod to the legitimacy or the persistence and protection of white fragility, but given that there are a number of people in this room that look like me, I will acknowledge first and foremost that some of what I'm going to say is going to be uncomfortable, and that's okay. Be uncomfortable and sit in that. For those of you who do not look like me, much of what I'm going to say is going to be no news to you, and you probably know that already. I do want to add two other notes before I begin, and that's about language. You might have already heard me in quoting W.E.B. Du Bois and Merton himself, that there are two important things we need to keep in mind when we look at texts that were published, speeches that were given prior to the second half of the 20th century. Thomas Merton died 50 years ago last December, 1968. And so the language that he used, both with regard to men and women, humanity in general, in around gender, was typically exclusive. And so language like man and mankind is deeply inappropriate for us today when we recognize the way that words function, that language functions, and that it excludes 50% or more of the world's population to describe humanity as, quote, man or mankind. Nevertheless, because Merton was a man of his time, it's so deeply pervasive, it becomes almost impossible in a way that would not distract from the conversation to change every instance of that. So on that point, I just want to draw our attention to the gender-exclusive language of some of the authors, particularly those like Merton. The other thing is the use of language to refer to those of African descent in the United States context. And so as was the common rhetoric, the common discourse of the 1960s, 50s, and 40s, as we saw in 1903 with W.B. Du Bois, as we see in the writings of Dr. King and of Malcolm X and so many others, Merton uses oftentimes the word Negro to refer to African Americans or those of African descent. And so just to brace ourselves that we recognize in our own time these are antiquated and in many ways deeply historically flawed and problematic terms. But Merton died in 68 and was very much a man of his time, as are some of the other authors that I might draw on. So when quoting them, we might see and hear some of that language. And again, I just want to draw our attention to that. Okay. Whiteness and the reality of systemic racism. Before we get to Merton, I think to begin, we need to acknowledge that race is a social construct. It is the false belief that superficial adaptations to geography, like skin tone or eye shape, are genetic and biological determinants that result in significant differences among groups of human beings. Many of us have been socialized, generally in a tacit or an unwitting way, to believe that there are actual biological or genetic distinctions between races that correlate to phenotype. When I say phenotype, I mean the way we look, which is the way one appears or is perceived according to skin color. But this is not correct. As scholar Robin DiAngelo explains, the idea of race as biological makes it easy to believe that many of the divisions we see in our world, in our society, are natural. But race, like gender, is socially constructed. The differences we do see with our eyes, such as hair texture or eye color, are superficial and emerged as adaptations to geography. There really is no race under the skin. The differences we believe we see, and here she gives some examples. For instance, Lakeisha is less qualified than Emily, or Jamal is more prone to violence. These that we, quote, believe to see in our context are a result of our socialization, our racial lenses. While there is no biological race, as we understand it, race as a social construction has profound significance and impacts every aspect of our lives. In discussions about race in the U.S., it's commonplace for white folk to recognize and talk about the burdens suffered by and the oppression of black women and men, or persons of African descent, indigenous peoples, and other people of color. But it's far less common for whites to recognize and talk about whiteness and its relationship to these burdens and oppression. While there are many reasons why this oversight or ignorance may be the case in a given circumstance, there are two key or predominant factors that undoubtedly shape this phenomenon within the American context. And these are the assumptions of normativity and the denial of structural racism. First, White folk do not generally talk about whiteness, because the dynamics that make possible the burdening and oppression of persons of color also cover over the reality of, quote, whiteness as a racial marker within the web of relations. Now, I need to go off script for a minute to make a comment. Typically, those who do talk a lot about whiteness are not doing so with adequate recognition to the relationship to racial oppression, right? Now, I'm not talking about whiteness as a point of superiority, quite the opposite here, right? As a result, that which is perceived to be white is viewed by whites socialized in an anti-black racist society and by persons of color who have internalized that same socialization. White is viewed to be normative, neutral, acceptable, ordinary, the default or the ideal. Because it's socially constructed, those who are considered white vary with time. Just as the theologian Brian Massengale has explained, he writes, it is important to note that white is in fact a fluid category that has come to include over the years ethnic groups from other parts of the world beyond those of Western European descent. Historians note that various groups immigrating to the U.S., despite ostensibly similar or shared phenotype, had been considered non-white until those in positions of dominance determined it was socially acceptable to include this or that ethnic population. Philosopher Sarah Ahmed further highlights this first reason that whiteness is not generally recognized by most white folk. She writes, it has become commonplace for whiteness to be represented as invisible, as the unseen or the unmarked, as non-color, the absent presence or hidden referent, against which all other colors are measured as forms of deviance. To be white is to be normative and without need for a qualifier in this society. As the theorist George Lipsitz explains, whiteness is everywhere in U.S. culture, but it can be very hard to see. As the unmarked category against which difference is constructed, whiteness never has to speak its name, never has to acknowledge its rule as the organizing principle in social and cultural relations. To sum up this occlusion of whiteness for white people, the philosopher George Yancey explains, the fact of the matter is that for white people, whiteness is the transcendental norm in terms of which they live their lives as persons, as individuals. People of color, however, confront whiteness in their everyday lives, not as an abstract concept, but in the form of embodied whites who engage in racist practices that negatively affect their lives. Black people and people of color thus strive to disarticulate the link between whiteness and the assumption of just being human to create a critical slippage. Elsewhere, Professor Yancey likens the socialization of whites into whiteness to the manner in which native English speakers learn English growing up. He says, one learns English in the context of every day by hearing it spoken. The subject of the language learning process, that is, the little kid, we'll say in this case, does not self-consciously incorporate the grammar of English, right? That's not typically, and if English isn't your first language, think of your first language. How did you learn it? He goes on, he says, yet parents engage in correcting the linguistic performances of their children. This is part of what it means to inhabit a linguistic community. Likewise, white people inhabit a racialized community in which they become white through subtle, uncritical, and tacit socialization. At times, there are stronger signals sent to correct the racial grammar of white performance, to use that language of Yancey yet again. A second factor that inhibits whites from recognizing the reality of whiteness is the pervasive denial of systemic or cultural racism today, particularly within the context of the U.S. The most common iteration of this dismissal takes the form of a conflation of racism with discrete acts of racial animus, such as the use of derogatory slurs or particular acts of violence. In this way, white people who do not actively seek to harm people of color or consciously hold disparaging prejudices against non-whites move or think of themselves in an exonerated sense, right? They free themselves or convince themselves and others that they're not guilty of the charges of racism or dare be labeled a racist. The truth is that racism is not limited to discrete or isolated racial actions or racist actions, but as a deeply embedded social reality from which no one is immune, whether you appear to benefit from this structure or are harmed by it. Furthermore, this conflation of discrete acts of racist animus that typifies what a racist, quote, does, with the structural and cultural reality of racism is made more contentious by the moral valences associated with the term racist, right? Nobody wants to be called a racist. Why? Why doesn't anyone want to be called a racist? Because racists are bad. And the way that this follows, right, is that racists are bad, but I'm good. Therefore, I can't be a racist. At issue here is the confusion of culpability and complicity. Indeed, those who act in overtly racist ways, who use derogatory language or promote a white supremacist ideology, they are personally culpable for the sin of racism, for sure. And yet, all of us who benefit from or are advantaged by a structurally racist society are complicit in the sin of structural or cultural racism. As Professor DeAngelo reiterates, racism is deeply embedded into the fabric of our society. It is not limited to a single act or a single person. Racism in this context is also not to be confused with race prejudice as such, she points out, which is when any individual or group, even those minoritized by and oppressed in a given society, hold biases against others based on race. I want to emphasize this for a minute because as I was preparing my remarks for tonight, I thought this would be a sidetrack thing, that I would just state this and move on. But social media has caught my attention this morning. I wrote a column, I'm a columnist for National Catholic Reporter, and I wrote a column this morning, well, that was published this morning, that raised some questions about the recent document, and I'll address this at the end of my talk, that the bishops released in November on racism, some of the things that were missing from that. And as you might imagine, in the very charitable, hospitable, gracious, and welcoming world of Twitter, a lot of folks were pointing out the so-called whataboutism that we find often in our politics. Well, what about persons of color who don't like whites? And what about tribal disputes in Africa? And what about various religious intolerance that exists in other places like India or in Pakistan? Or what about whites who can't get along with each other like you see with Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland and so on and so on and so on? And the point is simply this, and DeAngelo makes this quite clear. There's no such thing as racism in reverse. This is not racism. Because racism is what? As she says, it does not move back and forth, one day benefiting whites as an institution, and another day, or even in another era, benefiting people of color. It's historically inaccurate to suggest that. It's a false equivalency. The direction of power, she says, between whites and people of color, particularly in the United States, and that's where I'm limiting my remarks, because that's the context in which Thomas Merton was speaking, and that's the context in which we are sitting, or I am standing tonight. The direction of power, she says, between whites and people of color is historic, traditional, and normalized in ideology. And this is what is so difficult for those in the dominant position in a racist society to accept. That even if you are not personally guilty of racist actions as we popularly think of them, if you are white, like I am, as I identify, and as I am so often identified, we are nevertheless complicit in the racist structures of our society, of our institutions, and even of our church. Again, Professor DeAngelo, she offers a substantive definition of what we might mean by racism then to help us think about this. She says, racism is a form of oppression in which one racial group dominates others. In the United States, whites are the dominant group and people of color are the minoritized group. Thus, in this context, racism is white racial and cultural prejudice and discrimination, supported intentionally, and this is key, or unintentionally, by institutional power and authority, used to the advantage of whites and the disadvantage of people of color. Racism encompasses economic, political, social and institutional actions and beliefs which systematize, right? They concretize and perpetuate an unequal distribution of privileges, resources, and power between whites and people of color. A lot of critical race theorists, including Professor D'Angelo here, use this term, as you'll see on the presentation, minoritized. And I think that's an important term for us to keep in mind, particularly as the demographics shift in this country. Because minority is not just about a population or a headcount. Very, very soon, those who might be classified in the census as Caucasian or of white heritage of some sort or ethnic background constituted as white will be the, quote, minority by number. But as we know from our experiences looking around the world, and I'm not going to dwell on this, but in the Q&A we might bring it up, we can look to South Africa as an instance in which the numerical minority nevertheless was the dominant population in a given community, in a given context. So the minoritized population in apartheid South Africa, and I would still say the remnants of that exist today, despite their own internal political conflicts and tensions, the minoritized group were those black folk in South Africa, where the whites were those in the positions of dominance. What's key is that when this reality, this complexity of racism is avoided or denied, white folk further challenge their individual and collective ability to see their own participation in a racist context and recognize their own performative whiteness. Despite these challenges to white self-awareness, the philosopher Linda Martine Alcoff notes that research compellingly shows how whiteness impacts perceptual attunements and modes of interaction, as well as the associations and connotations that affect judgment. She's a good philosopher. That's a mouthful. What does she mean? Whiteness shapes identity formation, outlook on the world, and behavior, regardless of whether white people choose to acknowledge it or not. In her Analytic of Whiteness, Alcoff highlights three aspects of social identity in this regard. She describes the first, she calls it empirical whiteness. By this she means that which is approaching, that study that approaches the reality of whiteness as an object of empirical study. So that would be something like demography or geography, migratory and political shifts, institutional affiliations. It's the kind of stuff that the Pew Research Foundation presents us with, right? Or that the census might provide. We can talk about whiteness in terms of numbers and location and do white Americans prefer Coke or Pepsi? You know, those kinds of questions. Empirical whiteness. And we see something about the reality of whiteness present in that context. There's a second aspect that she names, and that's what she calls imaginary whiteness. And I need to be very clear. She's a philosopher. She's not talking about make-believe. She's not talking about falseness, right, or something that's untrue. Rather, by imaginary, she's talking about an approach to understanding whiteness with regard to the manner in which white people construct their imaginations, their outlooks. Those of you who are familiar with the work of the philosopher Charles Taylor and the way he talks about social imaginaries, this is what she's referring to, right? How white people understand the world and their sense of affiliation with or connection to others and to a white dominant community or nation. This is an approach to understanding whiteness as it functions to shade and form perception both individually and collectively. It's the way the lenses, the outlook on the world, the outlook on oneself and one's community is formed. Third, she proposes that there's this other kind of a way to approach whiteness, what she calls subjective whiteness. And again, to be specific, she doesn't mean like we talk about subjectivity as relativism, you know. But let's say you go to Toy Story 2 with your friend. You're coming back from the movie with your friend and one person says, "I really love that movie." And the other person said, "That was the worst movie I've ever seen. It just destroyed the whole Toy Story franchise. I can never think of Buzz Lightyear and Woody the same ever again." And then they would say, "Well, that's just, you know, a subjective opinion. That's your view." Or as they say in Latin, "De gustibus non disputatum est," right? In taste there is no dispute, we'll just have to walk away and agree to disagree. That is not what Professor Alcoff is talking about. She is using this as shorthand to describe the way of white being in the world. She brings together both the racialized construction of identity of whiteness with the manifold ways white people actively and unwittingly dismiss or ignore its truth in the manner in which whites are subjects in the world. How do white people exist in the world as white in a racialized, racist context? And she explains. She says, to say then that whiteness is involved in the constitution of the self means that our core set of routine perceptual and epistemological practices, right, how we see and how we learn, how we understand, and our everyday habits of social interaction, interpretation, and judgment need to be analyzed in relation to a specific racialization process involving whiteness. Such phenomena are not universal. Other groups may have less of an investment in epistemologies of ignorance, and their very survival may require better epistemic habits, such as the need to listen carefully to what others have to say. Let me translate the philosophies there for you. One of the benefits in our context of being socialized and identifying and being perceived as white is that you don't often have to think very much about what other people are thinking about you or about themselves or about the event or context. Others, on the other hand, as she said very starkly and truthfully, their very survival may depend on it. We can think about instances in our own country of the difference between the experience of performing whiteness, going about the world in this subjective whiteness sense that Elkhoff is talking about, when you're driving the car down the street, when you're leaving the lecture tonight, and the blue and red lights are in your rearview mirror. Oftentimes, white folk do not have to think very much other than, my mom is gonna kill me if you're one of the students here and you're about to get a ticket. If you're a person of color, that situation is extraordinarily different. And I don't need to tell that to those who here identify with that experience. But Elkhoff is making that point. Their very survival may require better epistemic habits, more attuned ways of paying attention and reading the signs and being extra careful and being preemptive. She goes on. We need to recognize that whiteness is not simply about our conscious awareness, nor is it simply about structural patterns of social inequality or cultural representations that we can simply repudiate. We also need to avoid assuming that everyone undergoes an essentially generic and universal process of personality formation that is only afterward connected to racialized differences. It's this last aspect that I think is of greatest interest, at least to me, in thinking about Merton's understanding of racism as a white problem. The question remains, and we'll get to that this evening, I hope, at least to begin thinking about it, what role did Merton's whiteness in all the ways acknowledged so far, including the ways in which it was overlooked or ignored, even in his own struggling with the realities of racial injustice in the U.S., how does whiteness play in his understanding of racism and racial justice? But before proposing a response to this question, I think we need to turn to the writings of Merton himself, and I want to highlight some of the ways that Merton's writings are indeed prophetic. And some of this may be familiar to some of you, especially if you've had Professor Hillis's Honors Merton Seminar, so throwing him under the bus there. I imagine there are many students here that have had that experience. There's a lot in Merton's writings on racism that is laudable and that reflects a truly prophetic quality, particularly when we view his social location in historical context. What was his social location and context? Well, he was a white Euro-American male, a renowned author who, at least in his time and now here at Bellarmine, was a household name. He was an ordained Catholic priest, which within the context of his church bestows certain kinds of status and perception. The negative sides of that is what we call clericalism. He was a cloistered monk, set somewhat apart from the rest of the world in the beautiful, beautiful bluegrass hillside of rural Kentucky. And he was doing this, he was living this, he was this during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. That's all important for us to keep in mind. In the midst of a setting that would appear to be among the least conducive to an experience of ongoing conversion to the signs of the times, to a growing awareness of the racial injustice that plagued the United States, Merton turned to the world, as we Merton scholars so often say, with conviction and moral clarity not found in many of his fellow white Roman Catholic clergy, let alone members of cloistered religious orders. I mean, the truth is, if you want to find a place where you don't have to think about the signs of our times, the troubles of our world, the injustices that our sisters and brothers face, regardless of the context or city or situation, there's no better place than going to the Abbey of Gethsemane for a silent retreat for a week, right? Tune out. And yet, his attunement to what scripture scholars would call the sensus plenior, right? The fuller meaning or fuller sense of the conditions of racial injustice in the U.S. is striking. It is. While he does not get everything exactly correct, and I'll say more about that in a few minutes, Merton does arrive at an awareness of and a response to several key realities that many, if not most, whites in his time and our time have overlooked or willfully ignored. While there are surely other areas that could be discussed, I want to highlight three notable dimensions of Merton's anti-racist writings that reveal a distinctly prophetic character. The first is he recognized and called out the reality of systemic or structural racism beyond the particularity of individual or overt racist acts. Second, he identified the anti-black racist culture embedded in American Christian communities, including the Roman Catholic Church. And third, he acknowledged white complicity in the establishment and perpetuation of systemic and institutional racism, which led him to proclaim with a great deal of confidence that indeed racism is a white problem. So first, the reality of systemic racism. The most well-known and well-read of Merton's anti-racist writings is his essay titled Letters to a White Liberal. It was written in 1963 in response to Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham jail. And this lengthy reflection on the nature of anti-black racism in the United States is presented as Merton's attempt to listen, process, and integrate what he was hearing and reading about the quest for racial justice, especially from the perspective of black authors and civil rights leaders. In the conclusion of that essay, Merton explains that his aim was as introspective as it was exoratory. You know, he was really doing this for himself, he suggests, stating plainly that what is necessary for white folk is that they actually listen to their black sisters and brothers. He writes, and I quote, "This is the, quote, message which the Negro is trying to give white America. I have spelled it out for myself, subject to correction, in order to see whether a white man is even capable of grasping the words, let alone believing them." End quote. White folk like him have to will to know, open themselves to the message and experience and instruction of those disadvantaged by the same unjust system that accrues unearned benefits and privileges to whites. Merton explains, and I quote again, "For the rest of you, for us, those who are reading his essay, you have Moses and the prophets." A nice allusion to Jesus in the Gospels. "You have Moses and the prophets." And then he says, "Martin Luther King, James Baldwin, and others. Read them and see for yourself what they are saying." End quote. So what are the modern anti-racist Moses and the prophets saying to white folk? From Merton's perspective, part of their admonition is focused on the pervasiveness of systemic racism. As Merton explains in his preface to the French translation of part of this letter, this reality all too often unacknowledged by whites is something governed by emotions and the unconscious. He says, and he's addressing a French audience here, right? "American racism has something of the character of an ineradicable and axiomatic conviction, which is accepted as the basis for an entire outlook on life and becomes the logical presupposition for inhumane conclusions. The chief of these is the justification of any form of violence, hatred, and cruelty." Merton regularly makes the important distinction between individual acts of racist animus and the reality of systemic racism. He describes the inherently unjust laws and structures that ground American society. For example, in an essay written in the fall of 1967, Merton observes the following. "It is pointless to say that the laws guarantee the Negro all the same rights as white people. We know that the laws are not enforced and the Negro is often denied his obvious rights. But also, economically speaking, The Negro remains in the same position as he was before, perhaps worse. He is convinced that there is no real place for him in our established society, except the very secondary place, which we will give him. It is a psychological impossibility for most white Americans really to accept a Negro as an equal in every respect, and the violent struggle against open housing has proved it. As I mentioned, or as Dr. Pearson mentioned, I live in Chicago. I live on the south side of Chicago in the Hyde Park neighborhood. And Chicago is not unique in the history of housing issues around race, also known as redlining. We see it in all the major cities in the north, right? Detroit, Chicago, Boston, Washington. Merton was very aware of this. In anticipating those whites who would protest the reality of structural and institutional racism by claiming that progress had been made and that there are now clear laws to protect people of color from unfair treatment, Merton says the following, and I quote, "You will point to the Supreme Court decisions that have upheld Negro rights to education in integrated colleges and schools. It seems to me that our motives are judged by the real fruit of our decisions. What have we done?" To his own question, he responds, quote, "We have been willing to grant the Negro rights on paper, even in the South. But the laws have been framed in such a way that in every case, the execution of the laws has depended on the goodwill of white society. And the white man has not failed, when left to himself, to block, obstruct, or simply forget the necessary action without which the rights of the Negro cannot be enjoyed in fact," end quote. Merton recognized that a structurally racist society such as we find here in the U.S. operates in an inherently unjust and violent manner. Though to those in positions of power or dominance, white folk in general and white men in particular, the system appears orderly, sensible, and just. This is the way it ought to be. This is the way we've always done it. In an article titled Toward a Theology of Resistance, Merton points to how this dynamic plays out within the American context, in which the white majority views crimes or violence in communities of color, communities segregated by the unjust laws and practices of racist society, and he says the following, and I quote, "But it must be remembered that the crime that breaks out of the ghetto is only the fruit of a greater and more pervasive violence, the injustice which forces people to live in the ghetto in the first place. The problem of violence, then, is not the problem of a few rioters and rebels, but the problem of a whole social structure, which is outwardly ordered and respectable, and inwardly ridden by psychopathic obsessions and delusions." For reference, the picture on the left is from the 1960s. The picture on the right is from 2015. Not much has changed. Think about the rhetoric that was used when Baltimore burned after the result of another unarmed black man being killed by police. The response by so many whites, particularly those on television and those in civil offices, those who have power, those who have a voice, more often than not, people who look like me, white men, it was, "There needs to be order. This is not how you do it. This is not right." Merton's point is, it doesn't begin here. This is a symptom of something that's far, far worse and not easily seen, particularly if you're in those positions of power. For Merton, this phenomenon of systemic racism as part and parcel of American culture is not limited to the sphere of civil politics and social norms, but it also implicates the Catholic Church and Christianity writ large in the U.S. So the second point, racism in American Christianity. Debunking the myth that racism exists only in the American South, Merton notes in a 1965 article on religion and race in the United States that African Americans in the North are quite aware of the deeply embedded institutional racism of Christianity in this country. He writes, and I quote, "The Northern Negro is, generally speaking, disillusioned with the churches and with the Christian preaching of moderation and nonviolence. His feeling is that the churches are part of the establishment," and Merton adds parenthetically, "which in fact they are," exclamation point. "They support the power structure, and therefore," African Americans believe, These power structures keep the Negro deluded and passive, preventing him from fighting for his rights, end quote. In recognizing, as he does, that the problem of American racism turned out to be far deeper, far more stubborn, infinitely more complex than most whites would care to admit, this raises urgent and perennial questions and concerns for the church. Merton recognized the choice placed before Christians in general and Christian leaders in particular, and he writes, I quote, "The American racial crisis, which grows more serious every day, offers the American Christian a chance to face reality about himself and recover his fidelity to Christian truth, not merely in institutional loyalties and doctrinal orthodoxies, but in recanting a more basic heresy, the loss of that Christian sense which sees every other man, every other woman as Christ and treats them as Christ." Because I think Merton's point is just all the more apropos today when we think about those who call out, particularly religious leaders who want to name issues like the racism surrounding policies at our southern border here in the U.S., of family separation, of structural racism as it affects people of color writ large. And oftentimes the same sort of discourse by those I like to call trolling pontiffs who go around and declare heresy, heresy, focusing on liturgy or esoteria, and oftentimes really bad theology. They clearly haven't come to Bellarmine to the theology department to study from Dr. Klassen or Dr. Hillis. It's of a piece. Merton's point is that when we talk about Orthodox Christianity, let us not focus on this minutia. Let us focus on the most fundamental thing, which is, are we living a life modeled after Christ? And who does Christ side with when it comes to racial injustice? Building on his writing about systemic racism more broadly, Merton makes clear that the consequences of racial injustice within the church is also a white problem, and one that requires choosing to acknowledge this reality and accept the conversion necessary to make some radical changes from the status quo. In addressing his fellow white Christians, Merton writes, "In the American crisis, the Christian faces a typical choice. The choice is not interior and secret, but public, political, and social. He is perhaps not used to regarding his crucial choices in the light of politics." Right? Two things we don't talk about in good company, politics and religion. Merton's saying here, no, actually, they're deeply intertwined. The Christian can now either find security or order by falling back on antique and basically feudal or perhaps even fascist conceptions, or go forward into the unknown future, identifying himself or herself with the forces that will inevitably create a new society. The choice, Merton says, is between safety based on negation of the new and reaffirmation of the familiar, or the creative risk of love and grace in new and untried solutions, which justice nevertheless demands. This focus on the choice at hand impugns the collective innocence of white Christians and the church writ large. Racism is a white problem within American Christianity because, as with the broader American context, the structures, the institutions, the norms, the loci of power are created and they are held by whites. And nothing will change until whites take responsibility and dare to risk the culture and societal change that is necessary. Which brings us to the third prophetic point of Merton's writings. White complicity in racism is a white problem. The most notably prophetic dimension of Merton's writings on race is his recognition of white complicity beyond discrete acts of racial animus. And he argues, right, he highlights, like the contemporary scholars we looked at a moment ago, he highlights the need for whites to acknowledge that the same situation that oppresses others works to their advantage and benefit. As I mentioned earlier, it's oftentimes easy, right, for white folk to see where there's clear harm, where there's injustice, although not everybody sees it so easily. For anything to change, though, white folk need to recognize that racism is a white problem. Again, in his letters to a white liberal, Merton explains why the truth of systemic racism is so threatening for most whites to acknowledge. "Here is why it is a source of uneasiness and fear to all white men who are attached to their security," Merton writes. "If they are forced to listen to what the Negro is trying to say, the whites may have to admit that their prosperity is rooted to some extent in injustice and in sin." And in consequence, this might lead to a complete re-examination of the political motives behind all our current policies, domestic and foreign, with the possible admission that we are wrong, end quote. Earlier in the very same essay, Merton acknowledges that the laws and social norms of our American society are deeply racist. I know that sounds like a stark language. We don't oftentimes talk this way, but it's true. They simultaneously oppress some and advantage others. Merton explains, he says, if we have got to the point where the laws are frequently, if not commonly, framed in such a way that they can be easily evaded by a privileged group, then the very structure of our society comes into question, end quote. And so here, you know, we can think of very contemporary examples. You know, if we don't want to think of what's happening right now in our immediate context, join me in imagining going back to the 1990s and the strict laws that were imposed at the federal level and beyond on illegal substances, drugs, for instance, and that the mandated prison time that was given for those who were convicted for selling or possessing crack cocaine, which was more common in communities of color than for powdered cocaine, which was more common for affluent whites, is an example of exactly this point, that for using the same narcotic, you know, those, as Merton says, right, from a privileged group can more easily evade the consequences. Merton was to some extent aware of how whiteness is performed in a structurally racist society such that, generally unbeknownst to the individual, white people actively participate in, re-inscribe, and therefore perpetuate the racist systems that is sinful and oppressive. In a lengthy passage added as an appendix to his essay, The Hot Summer of 67, Merton explains this, and it's lengthy, I want to quote it at length. Merton writes, there is, however, such a thing as collective responsibility and collective guilt. This is not quite the same as personal responsibility and personal guilt because it does not usually follow from a direct, fully conscious act of choice. Few of us have actively and consciously chosen to oppress and mistreat the Negro. But nevertheless, we have all more or less acquiesced in and consented to a state of affairs in which the Negro is treated unjustly, and in which his unjust treatment is directly or indirectly to the advantage of people like ourselves, people with whom we agree and collaborate, people with whom we are, in fact, identified. So that even if, in theory, the white man may believe himself well disposed toward the Negro and never gets into a bind which he proves himself otherwise, we all collectively contribute to a situation in which the Negro has to live and act as our inferior. I am personally convicted, Merton writes, that most white people who think of themselves as very, quote, fair to the Negro show, by the way they imagine themselves fair, that they consider the Negro an inferior type of human being, a sort of minor, and their fairness consists in giving him certain benefits provided he, quote, keeps in his place, end quote, the place they have allocated to him as an inferior. I would like to say that this state of mind is itself an act of inhumanity and injustice against the Negro and is in fact at the root of the trouble with the Negro so that anyone who holds such opinions, even in the best of faith, is contributing actively to the violence of the present situation, whether he realizes it or not. He is addressing the subtle and destructive ways that racism operates in the daily lives of white women and men. Part of that complicity manifests itself in the presumption, as we saw in discussing whiteness at the opening of this lecture, that the white experience is just taken for granted as normative and superior. Merton writes, and I quote, in simple terms, I would say that the message black people want whites to hear is this. White society has sinned in many ways. It has betrayed Christ by its injustices to races it considers, quote, inferior, and to countries which it colonized. In particular, it has sinned against Christ in its lamentable injustices and cruelties to the Negro, end quote. This sense of white superiority that pervades American society and collective historical memory is expressed bluntly as Merton reflects on this dynamic of white supremacy instituted in our society as it affects Native Americans in particular. He writes this in the all caps is in the original. That's how he typed it. But let us spell out quite clearly what this means. It means that as far as we are concerned, the Indian, like the Negro, the Asian, etc., is permitted to have a human identity only insofar as he conforms to ourselves and takes upon himself our identity. But since, in fact, the Indian or the Negro is in the position of having a different colored skin and other traits which make him unlike ourselves, he can never be like us and can never, therefore, have an identity. The lock snaps shut. The Indian, like the Negro, though perhaps less emphatically, is definitively excluded. In theory, we recognize his humanity. In practice, he is, like the Negro, at best a second-class human who tries to dress and act like ourselves but never quite manages to make the grade, end quote. Merton realized with prophetic clarity that racism in the United States is a white problem, which led him to state a sense of cautious hope that our society could be different. But it is up to white folk. For as he explains, as long as white society persists in clinging to its present condition and to its own image of itself as the only acceptable reality, then the problem will remain without reasonable solution, and there will inevitably be violence. Merton knew that the sickness of systemic racism was so pervasive, such an ideological cancer that has metastasized at all parts of American society, that radical change was necessary. But that change, he argues, has to begin with white folk. To put it bluntly, nothing would change until white folk surrendered their privilege and unspoken sense of supremacy and normativity. So these three areas that I've talked about highlight the prophetic nature of Merton's writings, but what about its limitations? Well, Merton was far ahead of many white Roman Catholic clergy in his time, and as I've said, and others like Father Brian Massengale, who has delivered this lecture in previous years, have said as well, this is true of our time too. There are nevertheless limits to his understanding and discussion of race in the American context. And I want to just briefly highlight three such limitations that we should note. The first, the insights in recent decades of scholars of critical race theory, some of whom I've shared their reflections at the beginning of my talk, offer us points to consider when looking at the role of Merton's own whiteness and the role it played in his anti-racist writings. A helpful starting point is to plainly recognize what scholars like Barbara Applebaum have noted. She writes, "Even whites who are willing to acknowledge that whites are the problem of racism and who are sensitized to the ways that whiteness works through its invisibility are not exempt from being implicated in racism," end quote. This stark reminder rightly implicates me, by the way. Just because I'm up here, don't think that I think I'm exonerated or outside of this. I am deeply embedded in a racist culture just like we all are, and it affects me just like it affects us all. It also affects Merton, which is something for all of us to keep in mind. It's not merely enough to speak the truth of systemic racism and white complicity or to state a position of solidarity, as Merton does at one point. He says at one point, "I, for one, remain for the Negro. I trust him. I recognize the overwhelming justice of his complaint. I confess I have no right whatever to get in his way, and that as a Christian, I owe him support, not in his ranks, but in my own, among the whites who refuse to trust him or hear him and who want to destroy him," end quote. Genuine and well-intentioned as that statement surely is, Merton's writings could be interpreted at times as an effort to signal his own innocence, awareness, or, as it is said frequently today, that Merton wanted to signal that he was, quote, woke, end quote. As Applebaum reminds us, though, given the deeply embedded and socialized reality of systemic racism, whiteness continuously, she says, ensnares and ambushes white people, so that whiteness finds ways to hide even as one attempts honest efforts to resist it. Being an anti-racist white, therefore, is a project that always requires another step and does not end in a white person having arrived in the form of an idyllic anti-racist. We can see this dynamic at work in the variation of perspective that Merton offers over the course of his writings on race during the 1960s. In the wake of the increasing violence and the rise of the Black Power movements near the end of that century, the end of that decade, Merton begins to appear at times to equivocate in his later writings about the validity and the problematics of civil rights protests as they become more violent. He seems to want to hold on to earlier claims he made during the nonviolent demonstrations of MLK, as well as so many others, that racism is an inherently white problem in the United States. But it appears in his essay, The Hot Summer of 67, that while the performance of whiteness and the policies of dominance have led to this violence, and he recognizes that, he nevertheless calls for a, quote, both sides approach to responsibility and sublimates the social, political, and cultural problems into a spiritual crisis. At times, he struggles to accept the analogs he himself makes of the violence in search of racial justice, such as when he offers this recap. He says, to sum it up, the problem as I see it is this. The Negro has, in some sense, abandoned the struggle for civil rights. Oof, really? Okay. He goes on, he has given up Christian nonviolence as feudal idealism. He has decided that whitey only understands one kind of language, violence. The Negro has concluded that if whitey wants to terrorize Vietnamese with napalm and other cozy instruments of war, he should have a little taste of what fire and terror feel like at home, end quote. There's a lot there. The change in tone reflects the ambivalence Merton feels toward maintaining his otherwise consistent theme of racism as a white problem. Here, that thesis begins to slip, not totally, but a little, as he signals the blame ought to be shared by at least those people of color, maybe, perhaps, who do not subscribe to Dr. King's earlier nonviolent approach. Some question marks start to rise. A second limit, right? So that's the first. The second is the reinscription of white normativity present in Merton's writing, even as he at times explicitly identifies this as problematic. And this, I think, speaks to what I shared at the outset of my lecture, that it's so deeply interwoven into the fabric of socialization and identity formation that even Merton isn't aware, you know, as I will confess, I am oftentimes so unaware. It requires active attention. Take, for example, a brief passage in Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, in which, as an aside, this isn't even his point, but it's worth noting, he reveals a perception that only non-whites, quote, have race. Merton writes the following. The core of the race problem, as I see it, is this. The Negro, and then in parentheses, also other racial groups, of course, but chiefly the Negro, is victimized by the psychological and social conflicts now inherent in a white civilization that fears imminent disruption and has no mature insight into the reality of its crisis. White society is purely and simply incapable of really accepting the Negro and assimilating him because white people cannot cope with their own drives, cannot defend themselves against their own emotions, which are supremely unstable in a rapidly changing and overstimulated society, end quote. Again, a lot to unpack there. But think about the presumption in the introduction and how he switches, right? Racialized groups, and what is whiteness? We see this elsewhere too, and Merton ties the reality of American racism to the experiences of colonization and subjugation of populations around the globe, such as the case when he associates African Americans in solidarity with, quote, colored races in all parts of the world, end quote. It would appear that Merton's own white self-criticality was limited by his own socialization, which despite his best intentions, nevertheless prevented him at many times from recognizing his own whiteness as a marker of race itself. Given his spiritual outlook and concern about the role of the church in a systemically racist context, Merton is, it pains me to say it, but it's true, he's notably sloppy about the way he sometimes refers to Christians or Christianity in distinctively white terms. Oftentimes, the rhetorical device is that, quote, Christians need to do something about racism, that their complicity in systemic racism is sinful. And as true as that statement is, it too often lacks the necessary qualifier white, as in white Christians. This oversight, unintentional as it may have been, nevertheless belies an important limitation. Right? The language comes up oftentimes. He's presuming people like him. Well, what about black Christians? What about black Catholics? Finally, a third limitation in Merton's writings is the way he views the relationship between whites and blacks, the problem, as it were, and the oppressed. This has two iterations worth noting. One is the way he talks in terms that are complementary, and I don't mean with an I, like, ah, nice shoes. And the other is pedagogical or pedagogy. In terms of complementarity, there are several passages, particularly in Letters to a White Liberal, where Merton describes the, quote, necessity of black women and men for white folk. It's a curious thing. While clearly attempting to identify our social and ecclesial interdependence, recognizing that we are part of one family of humanity and within Christianity of the body of Christ, the framing of the complementary nature of the races could be read as instrumentalizing the existence of black folk for the sake or benefit of whites. In a passage, we read the following. This means to say that a genuinely Catholic attitude in matters of race is one which concretely accepts and fully recognizes the fact that different races and cultures are correlative. They mutually complete one another. The white man needs the Negro and need to know what he needs and need to know that he needs him. Sorry for the typo. White calls for black just as black calls for white. That's another typo, my apologies. There is here a diminished sense of agency and intrinsic identity, leading toward a problematic utilitarian understanding of racial justice. At least that's one possible limitation. A second is seen in the way that Merton at times invokes black authors and leaders as responsible for the education of white folk, and this is a big problem. Again, it seems benign enough, but there is a form of instrumentalizing people of color for the edification of white anti-racist intentions when white folk all too often, particularly it continues in our time, expect black women and men to teach or educate them. The proper response is to come to see one's participation in and performance of whiteness as a social field and a racial marker in a systemically racist society, and then educate oneself. Realizing one's whiteness ought to be the beginning of an ongoing and lifelong process of conversion and education. The philosopher Bridget Newell notes, and I quote, "The realization itself positions one to take responsibility to learn more about racism and whiteness, accepting the wisdom and experience of others, but not passively waiting for others to impart wisdom or teach her." At times, Merton clearly goes out of his way to educate himself, but his overall writing on the importance of whites hearing the voices of people of color is ambivalent at times in terms of whose responsibility or whose, we might say, problem it is to learn and to be educated. In conclusion, there is, I promise you, much, 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 much more that could be said about Thomas Merton's writings on race and racial justice, as well as the role that whiteness plays in his own experience and outlook. His writings still contain a strongly prophetic valence and remain timely as systemic racism continues to persist today. Nevertheless, this does not mean that his writings on race and racial justice are without fault or without limitation. Indeed, his work can and does serve as an important starting point, but we ought to supplement and at times critique his writing with the best of critical race theory and other contemporary scholarship, which offers us a more multidimensional understanding of the reality of racism in the American context. In closing, it's worth noting that Merton's wisdom and striking ability to read the signs of the time still exceeds that of the primary ecclesial leaders in the United States. Last November, as I mentioned earlier this evening, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops approved a pastoral statement on racism titled "Open Wide Our Hearts," in which they attempt to highlight and discuss the problem of racism today. It was the first major statement in 40 years after they released what I call the abysmally titled, quote, "Brothers and Sisters to Us" in 1979. I'll let that sink in for a minute. Sadly, as I've noted elsewhere, the bishops in the new document never use the terms privilege or supremacy. And when they used the term white only three times in the whole document, it was always in the context of generally positive historic references to ages long ago. There's a section on Native American experiences in the U.S. context, and the bishops talk about whites in terms of immigrants and pioneers. Pioneers? The other thing that's notable is that the new document discusses in passive and elusive terms the reality of oppression and violence as a result of racism, but it fails to identify the cause of the problem or the perpetrator. African Americans were harmed. That's the phrasing. In an apparent effort to allay the fears of white folk, that's my suspicion. The document presents, I believe, a false narrative that has been described by scholar Eduardo Bonilla Silva, what he describes as racism without racists. People of color happen to befall these unfortunate circumstances. Nobody did it to them. So in serious closing, for all his contextual and self-critical limitations, especially in light of the bishop's document, which has some really good things about it, it's good that we're talking about it at all, but it is very inadequate. At least Thomas Merton was able to plainly state that in the United States, racism has been and remains a white problem. Thank you.